keyboards.
Okay, welcome to the Stage Left podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. On this episode, we speak to another unsung hero of the music industry, Mike Farrell. As well as playing keyboards for Morrissey, Mike has toured with the likes of Alanis Morissette, Vanessa Carlton and Richie Sambora, and supported none other than David Bowie on tour as Macy Gray's musical director. Today on the Stage Left podcast, we'll be finding out what it's like to be produced by Tony Visconti, how one goes about composing songs for Morrissey's approval, and having worked with both Mariah Carey and will.i.am, Mike will be passing on advice to young musicians on working with big personalities in high-pressure environments. Having been heavily involved in the composition of one of my favourite songs of all time, this is an episode of the Stage Left podcast I'm especially looking forward to. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left podcast is Mike Farrell. Thanks for joining us, Mike. How's it going?
Thank you for having me, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great stuff, great stuff. So I believe kind of the most recent thing you've been involved in is you've been composing some music for a new series, is that right, that's appearing on Netflix, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. There's a couple music film scoring projects I've been working on with a friend of mine, Craig Wedren. He and I and another friend of ours have done the music for Blunt Talk, which is the new Patrick Stewart sitcom.
Yep.
On Stars, and then in conjunction, kind of at the same time, we were also doing some music for Wet Hot American Summer, which is a Netflix comedy that just came out.
Great. And tell us how it differs, writing music for film, than obviously composing. I mean, are you given a lot of briefs to kind of work to, or do you get a lot of artistic freedom in how you want to kind of write your music for particular scenes in either films or TV programs?
I think it depends on your relationship with the creators of the TV or film project. In some cases, they are very happy to give you free rein to do whatever you want and then react to that. In other cases, other people are more hands-on and they want to give you specific instructions about what types of instruments they want to hear or what type of music they want to hear. Either of those cases is fine, and I've worked in both of those situations, and it just kind of depends on how you've developed your vibe with the director.
On the times that you've actually written parts and it's kind of been down to you to interpret the scene and write your own music, have you ever kind of submitted some work where the director said, no, you've kind of either misinterpreted it or it's conveying the wrong emotion, perhaps?
Oh, definitely. It's one of the things about working in film and TV is you're dealing with incredibly motivated people. They work very hard and they've thought a lot about what they're doing. So they tend to have very specific and definite ideas of what they want. There are times where you do something and the director goes, I love it, it's great, we're putting it in, and that's kind of it. Those are a little more rare. Oftentimes it's kind of the middle ground where they say, we really like this, it's too long, I don't like that sound. You kind of pick through it and get specific about it. And then you kind of narrow in on exactly what they're looking for. That's typical. And then every now and then, quite rarely, that they just go, you're wrong, you're totally wrong, you blew it, start over.
Yeah, because there was an example, you probably know of a TV show over here called, hosted by Jonathan Ross, and he had Quentin Tarantino on, and Jonathan's a film critic as well, and he was kind of badgering Quentin Tarantino why he doesn't get more scores written for each scene in his film, and why he kind of taps into archives.
Right.
And when he finally got it out of Quentin Tarantino, he said it's because he doesn't want the composer to have more control over the film than I have myself, which is a perfect example of the freedom that you can get in composing music for film and how that can actually take over a scene and how it can be misinterpreted.
The Tarantino thing, you know, he's known for kind of finding those jewels of recordings from the 60s and 70s that people have lost or aren't aware of, and then all of a sudden they turn up in his film and they kind of get this new life of, oh wow, what's that cool song that I never heard before? It's, you know, Quentin Tarantino went and found it from some Hong Kong kung fu film or something.
Yeah, it's great. And when you're writing music for things like, I know you did like Third Rock from the Sun and Buffy, and I think you're quite involved in stuff like that. Obviously, they're quite classic shows. Do you try and second guess yourself about what you're trying to write in each scene, given the genre of what you're writing?
For sure. You have to keep your eyes on, I think you have to first of all, determine what I would like to do. And then in addition to that, you have to factor in what the director wants and kind of balance all those things, because often they're not the same thing. Like I said, if you have free reign, you might do it one way. The director is definitely going to have opinions about how he wants you, or he or she wants you to do it. And then, so based on those two things, then what is the actual correct way and what way will work the best? So sometimes it's a compromise. Sometimes it's, it's just one way or the other.
Cool. Thanks for your insight. So where did your musical story start, Mike? Did you have a musical family?
I did. My mother was a piano teacher, so I started taking piano lessons from her. I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, which is in the Midwest, mm-hmm. in the States. And actually, although it's not a larger city, it has a very, very prominent music community. Much more so in the classical world. The Cleveland Orchestra is quite well known. There's some schools in Cleveland, the Institute of Music and the Music Settlement, which are noted for being good schools, but in the classical world. And then also Cleveland has kind of a rock and roll reputation as well. So I grew up there and took piano lessons from my mother for a number of years. And as I got to be a teenager, I became more interested in the radio and started to play in bands, rock bands and jazz combos and different things like that. And it just kind of took off from there. I went to university for economics. My parents were supportive of me entering the music business, but they said it's a good idea for you to go get your degree. I went and did that, and then after a few kind of around the world type adventures, I moved to LA, became a musician when I was 24.
Great. And what were your specific ambitions when you started playing an instrument? Can you remember what you were trying to achieve?
I don't really. When I started piano lessons, I was just trying to get my mother off my back. She really wanted me to play, and I said, okay, I'll start. And, at first I kind of was okay, and I didn't like it that much. But what really kicked it into gear was when I began listening to the radio and I began getting into pop music. With a classical background and with kind of the training of a more rigorous reading environment, pop music is much easier to grasp. So because I had been taking classically and I became interested in pop music, it was very easy for me to kind of divulge what's going on in a pop song and go, I think that's just a G and a C and a D. So from there, it was kind of like I kind of already almost knew how to do it. I kind of understood the musical underpinnings of it quite quickly, and that was part of why I got so jazzed by it right away.
Do you think the theory kind of foundation that you had gave you a lot more confidence when kind of working with a lot of artists, knowing that, you could pretty much interpret or write something just given the key?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that technical, mechanical part of it is one thing, and that I feel very comfortable in, but there's a whole other side of it, which is the emotional, creative component. So a lot of artists that I work with do not have that kind of training. They don't know about chords and writing things out, and they don't really need to know because they have, they're so creatively driven. All that training was great. I don't particularly use it very much in a lot of cases.
I've interviewed people who have done some great stuff, worked with the likes of Sheryl Crow, and they've come from the other side where they were just kind of self-taught and knew no theory, and they were kind of on stage with Sheryl Crow and her saying, right, go and play this, and he had to kind of get that message across that actually he didn't read any music, and it's pretty daunting, I'd imagine.
It sure is.
Tell us, so you moved to LA around the age of 24 to become a professional musician. How did that actually work? How did you go from being, okay, I want to be a professional musician, to actually getting into paid regular work?
So I moved here, and I had some friends in the TV and film business, and when I moved out, the immediate job that I got was working as a production assistant on a set, which is you're a gopher. You get things and you take people places and you pick up lunch, and that's kind of the entry level job if you're into film production. So I started doing that, and I did that for about 18 months just to pay the bills. And all the while, I was, you know, trying to get into bands and meeting musicians and going to see bands and clubs and auditioning for different things. And after a while, I got a I had been doing this very obscure new musical out in the eastern part of LA, and there was a main piano player, and I was playing keyboards, and he said to me one day, he said, you know, I was going to take this touring job, but it turns out I can't go, you know, my partner's sick, and I have to stay here. Do you want me to put your name in? And I said, sure. And so that was, then I got an audition, and then I got a job, and after that, that was a touring group, like a jazz type thing that went to Europe, and after that, it was just kind of, it was rolling, and the most important thing that you can do, I think, is to go out and see musicians play and meet them. You know, if you see somebody that you like in a club, if you like his 59 Telecaster, or if you like the way he plays, or if you think he's got a cool vibe, go talk to him and meet him. And you know, most musicians, even the very successful ones that I met, are the same. They are hungry to find people that are into music like they are.
That's great advice. Tell us about, you obviously worked with Macy Gray for some time, and your role at one point was the musical director. I just wonder if you could elaborate on what that role entails and describe the working relationship between the musical director and artist.
Mm-hmm. Usually, the musical director is kind of the, I mean, there's a lot of administrative details that you also fulfill, but kind of you're in charge of the band. Sometimes the artist will be very busy, and that means you run the rehearsals. You might consult with them in picking a set list. You might help them, determine personnel, what they're going to need on tour. Do we need two guitar players? Do we need one guitar player? Do we need backup singers? More and more nowadays, that involves: are we going to use tracks? You know, how does that? What kind of gear do we need for that? How will that work with our live show? Will that cramp us as far as, you know, being chained to the track? So all those musical details, the musical director is kind of in charge of. And oftentimes, the artist, as I said, they don't necessarily have the vocabulary to deal with other musicians. So you kind of can help them with that. And also, they don't have the time, too, because there are great demands placed on them in terms of PR and, you know, appearances and doing the different kinds of things to keep their career going.
And so would you implement the ideas that they've come up with, or, you know, who has the final kind of say on that, or is it kind of a democratic process?
It depends on the situation. Usually the artist has the final say. I mean, it's their vision, and their name is on the bill.
Yeah, yeah.
Unless you're in a band situation where we're all members of the band, which is not, most of the situations I've been in have not been like that. You know, it says Macy Gray, so Macy Gray determines.
And how is Macy to work with? What's your experience working with Macy Gray? Is she good fun to work with?
She's very good fun. She's quite quirky and unusual, but super fun and super nice. And it was always fun to work with her because her bands tended to be very large, which is fun. It's fun to play with 10 musicians. And it just makes it, you know, there's just more friends around to hang around with and do things with, so.
Great. And I know that for one tour that you opened for Bowie for about 6 weeks at the end of 2003, tell us about that. I mean, obviously one of the greatest living musicians. What was that like, opening for him?
That was amazing. That was a real treat for a lot of reasons. You know, first of all, we got to play amazing places. I believe we played the Madison Square Garden on that tour. We did all kinds of the Shrine in L.A. There were lots of neat venues that we got to play in. And also, he's such a professional. I mean, he was there every day at soundcheck, whether he was ill or tired or not. He was there every day, and the band would rehearse, and they would go over new material, and they would work in. Every night they would work new material in, and it was quite impressive. And one other reason is, you know, from my perspective, I'm always interested in the musicians in the band, and he had a great band with him, and a lot of great musicians, Gail Ann Dorsey on bass, and David and Gail Ann singing Under Pressure, the song he did with Freddie Mercury, was one of the highlights every night. And every night, that was a goosebumps moment. You know, I would go out and watch it every night because it was amazing.
Change up!
depression. To see Mike Garson, his longtime piano player who played in the Spiders from Mars, fantastic kind of avant-garde jazz pianist, Earl Slick, Jerry Leonard, Sterling Campbell on drums. It was a great band, and I think Bowie's kind of benevolent, kind of good vibe made the tour really, really special.
Other than obviously he's being at the sound checks and his kind of obviously attention to detail and hard work, what would a young musician have learned perhaps as a performer from kind of observing him from such close proximity that you did for that time?
Well, I think he's, at that point, he was 30, 35 years into his career, and you would think that at some point you'd lose interest, but he didn't. You know, he's there every day, he loves music, he wants it to be good, even though he's certainly in a position where he can kind of skate and, you know, show up at 10 to 8 and start the show, and it probably would be great. But he still cares enough about it to be trying different material and tinkering with the set, and I just think that's impressive. It's impressive to keep that, keep the fire burning for that long.
Great stuff, thank you. And obviously you've worked with a producer who's obviously worked with almost all his albums, Tony Visconti. Tell us about that. I mean, we'll get on to Morrissey in a moment, but how did Tony Visconti's kind of production technique compare to other people? Because I think, were you involved in the big album that was produced by Will.i.am? Is that right?
I was, although just as a songwriter, I wasn't actually on site for very much of that.
Okay, that's fine. Tell us, what about Tony Visconti? Because I know you wrote songs for that particular album. Was he involved in that process?
That was the ringleader of the Tormentors record, which we did in Italy, which was an adventure. Really fun to be in Italy with the band and with Morrissey. That part of it was great. The part of it that was not so great was we showed up and this, you know, the studio situation was a little dicey, and it took a long time to get everything sorted out. And there was a producer that had been originally hired, and he kind of was wrestling with that and wrestling with a lot of things. So there was a long period of false start at the beginning of that. We were maybe 2 weeks in, and we hadn't really done very much. And so it was decided that a change needed to be made. We brought in Tony, and Tony really organized the whole record and made it into, he saved it in a way. But with a brand new broken fortune, and once again I turn to again, I do. I turn to you. It was interesting to see the different kind of hats that a producer has to wear, because in that situation, it wasn't really about the music. The music was ready, the band was there. It was more about organizing it, you know, dealing with all the technical situations that we had to deal with, and kind of pursuing it, you know, in an organizational manner, much more so than musically. He did a great job of that. I mean, we were on a very kind of regular schedule, and it was after he arrived, it flowed very well.
He got the job done well.
Yeah.
Tell us about different producers you've worked with in perhaps different techniques that you've seen over the years, and how producers have kind of used techniques to get the best out of particular artists or particular musicians.
Mm-hmm. I always feel like when you get hired to play on something, that the first thing you should do should kind of be your own vibe. And a lot of producers feel that way too. They might say, here's the song, check it out, and do what you feel first. And that's kind of a good way to start, because that would be certainly the most personal and most unusual, I guess, thing that I'm going to deliver. Maybe not unusual, but at least the most personal, most attached to me. And then from there, often the producer will give you some guidance and you know, get into the nuts and bolts of what you're playing. So I like to do that. I like to kind of do my thing first of all, and then let them respond to that. And a lot of producers like that. Sometimes the producer will be much more specific and say, and here's what I want. I want you to do this. And then when I get to the chorus, I want you to do this. And that's fine too. You definitely have to be a little bit egoless, because the point is not really the piano part. The point is the song. The point is and much more so the vocal than the piano. So you're just kind of a building block in the house, and you need to not be too offended by them hating what you played, or, you know, trying to get you to play something different.
That's good advice. To talk to me about, obviously, you were 4 years with Morrissey. Firstly, I think you joined just after You of the Quarry was recorded and for that subsequent tour. You know, were you a Smiths fan growing up? Did you know the material?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. In high school, I listened to, I went to high school in the late 80s, and there was a movement at that time in America, which they called college rock. The Smiths were right in the middle of it with The Cure and New Order and Echo and the Bunnymen and a lot of British bands. And I do remember the very first time that I ever heard How Soon Is Now, because it was such an unusual song. That was the first Smith song that I heard. It was such an unusual song. It was such an unusual voice, unusual lyrics, and even unusual kind of production and you know, parts that Johnny Marr came up with. So I can very clearly recall that in high school.
And I specifically remember from my research that there was a particular time you played that particular song at Reading. And
that's
you said
right.
The crowd...
The first time, I believe. I think it was the first time he played that song since The Smiths. And it was pretty amazing.
Awesome.
The Reading Leeds Festival, and I think we opened with that, and the crowd gasped. It was very, very strange, because usually people cheer, or they scream, or they boo, or whatever. But they gasped. It was amazing.
Fantastic. So tell us about the early stage of that. I mean, I think you had to have an interview for the job. Tell us about that and what you remember about that tour. I actually saw you at Glastonbury on that tour.
Oh, yeah.
And it's really great that I'm interviewing you, because I love those two albums. Obviously, I know you weren't in the recording process of You of the Quarry, but that tour and obviously into the Ringleaders album as well. Tell us what you remember about that tour and perhaps the Glastonbury gig.
So I got offered the job, I got the opportunity to come meet with him because I knew Dean Butterworth, who was playing drums and played drums on You Are the Quarry. He was a friend of mine, and we had worked in L.A. together, so he put my name forward. Again, this is why you need to go out and meet musicians and be nice to them, talk to them, help them, you know, because those are the people that are going to bring jobs to you, like, you know, Dean brought me that one. So I went and met with Morrissey, and we got along great, and it was funny, you know, I didn't have to play anything. He just kind of wanted to get my personal vibe. A huge part of being on tour with a group of people is how you conduct yourself personally. You know, the music is one thing, and you have to do that job. But if you're a disruption, or if you cause problems, it's the quickest way to get, you know, end up being off the tour. So he interviewed with me, and it went great. And then he offered us the job. And the next thing I knew, we were doing. I think we did a few dates in L.A. We did a few dates in New York, and then we were off to Europe for the summer. So, yeah, the Glastonbury, that was a great night. I believe we were second on the bill to Muse, I think.
That's right.
Is that right?
Yeah, it was a Saturday night, I think it was. Yeah.
Yeah, great, you know, those are some great festivals. That You Are the Quarry tour was so well received.
I was a good kid, I wouldn't do you no harm. I was a nice kid with a nice paper round. Forgive me any pain I've brought to you. With God's help, I know I'll always be near to you. But Jesus hurt me when he deserted me, but
celebration in Manchester in 2004 at the MEN Arena, and that was, I remember that being one of the most off the hook jobs I did with him. The whole place just seemed to be rising, levitating. It was, you know, like an insane crowd, hometown crowd.
So you understood the importance of some of his music to like a large portion of people. I mean, he's obviously such a influential artist, and his music means a lot to people. If you listen to, I've got a great recording I'm going to cue in a moment, of you playing There Is a Light, and you know, the reaction of the crowd is just absolutely magic, and incredible artist. Now, what would someone have learned from Morrissey's working practices, perhaps a front man or a performer or in rehearsals? What could someone have learned from Morrissey?
Morrissey, similarly to Bowie, is very hands-on with rehearsal and with the set list. And at the beginning of the tour, he will send you a big, long list of songs to learn. You know, not all of which we will play every night, but, you know, to know 35 or 40 songs, because he likes to change it up every night, which I think is good for all of us. It makes us, you know, kind of perks us up and keeps us engaged. And it also allows his fans, especially the ones that go to repeat shows, to have a different experience. And that's a big part of it. You know, you were talking about what an influence he is in Britain. He also, in America, perhaps not so pervasively, but there is a subsection of Morrissey fans in America that are incredibly devoted and feel the same way that, you know, a lot of Britain does about it. It's an interesting thing. You know, when I tell people about Morrissey, people that I've worked with Morrissey, there's two reactions. One of them is blank, you know, I've never heard of him. And that happens a lot. And then the other one throws himself at my ankles and hugs me, you know, like they can't believe that I've touched Morrissey. So that's an interesting thing.
Take me out tonight. Oh, take me anywhere. I don't care, I don't care, I don't care. And in the dark and underpass, I thought, oh God, my chance has come at last. But then a strange fear gripped me and I just couldn't ask.
So you recorded the ringleader of the Tormentors album in Italy, and I think you wrote a couple of songs for those sessions. Tell us how you approached writing the songs. You know, did you have Morrissey in mind specifically, or were they songs you had lying about? And the second part of that question is, how did he receive them at first, and how did you go about presenting them to him? Were you confident with them?
As far as writing the songs, they all were written with him in mind. At one point during a discussion, he had mentioned that he wanted to pursue some more orchestral type things. And that was what led me in kind of down the direction with At Last I Am Born and Sweetie Pie and some of the other demos that didn't make it on the record. Collaborating with him is really interesting because, and apparently this is how he's always done it. I've heard Johnny Marr talk about it. You know, you do the whole thing as an instrumental track. You do a 3.5-minute song and you put drums on it, you put everything on it that you want on it, except any vocal or any melody. I mean, you just hand it to him and he either likes it or he doesn't. So, I mean, there's sometimes you just send him stuff and there's just never any reply. With Ringleader, it was funny because, you know, there's a number of co-writers and we were all sending him material. And then at one point, there was a huge packet that arrived in the mail and it had all the songs on it. For the record, and you know, it didn't say who wrote what, and of course I don't know what the names of the songs are, so you kind of go through the whole thing and listen to the whole thing, oh, that's a Boz song, and oh, this is, you know, and so that was kind of how it happens. It's although it is a collaboration, it's not a very engaged collaboration. He likes to work on his own in private, and I'm not sure he's as comfortable sitting in a room with three songwriters as other situations where, you know, you're kind of hammering it out and saying, yeah, I like that, no, I don't like that. He wants to be private about it, and it's more of a back and forth. So with the songs that I did, there was very little, you know, he just liked it, and he just wrote on it, so that was kind of it. And, you know, every now and then he'll say, oh, can we maybe do it in a different key, or can we put one more of this section there, but it's very, very limited. Usually it just either happens or it doesn't.
So when you were composing these songs, there must have been a melody in your own mind, perhaps to the music, or were you just literally writing, a blank canvas with a verse, chorus, or whatever it might be? Because that must be unusual, right? Composing like that.
I guess I did have a melody in my own mind, although at this point I don't recall it really, because, you know, his vibe is so unique and interesting and unusual that it just kind of takes over the song. Like, I would have never even conceived of the phrase, At Last I Am Born. You know, that's a total
classic Morrissey, yeah.
Right. So I, you know, that the thought never occurred to me in all my years.
At last I am born, historian's notes, I am finally born, I once used to chase, affection withdrawn, but now I just sit back and yawn, because I am born, born, born.
One of the great things about being able to interview today is that you actually played and played on and was kind of at the embryonic stages and through to being playing live one of my favourite songs ever, which is an unusual song for a Morrissey choice for someone's favourite song, and that's Life is a Pigsty. Tell us what you remember about that song and the early stages of that.
That was Alan White's song, and that was on that in that packet on that list, and I remember listening to it thinking how unusual it was, and Alan was talking about how, you know, there's rain in it and there's him hitting on glasses and there's lots of unusual sound effects on the demo that those just went right onto the track, which are, you know, that they add to the vibe, and they're a really neat part of it. Alan had pretty much come up with the piano part, which is it's very simple, kind of really elegant, simple part, which I loved to play. And then it became kind of this epic jam. First in the recording, became kind of this epic thing, and then much more so live, it just turned into, you know, tumbled into this great live piece where it's became kind of this nuts thing.
It's an absolute masterpiece. I mean, it's obviously a song in different parts because you've got that kind of early groove in the first half and then it builds to a huge crescendo. How similar was the final kind of recording to the first thing that you heard of it? Did it build in the same way?
The first part of the song was the same. Pretty much up to the kind of where it changes time and breaks down into a more ethereal thing. And then I think in the studio we kind of mushroomed out that section into something bigger. But because Morrissey writes the way that he does, I think once the song is done in his mind, it won't really change. You know, it wouldn't go, okay, now we're going to do another verse, because he wouldn't have written another verse. And you know, so I mean, it kind of, and that's in a sense why it developed the way it did. The first part of the song was the way it was, and then when we got to the instrumental part, there was nothing that he had kind of rooted there, so that became a little showpiece for the musicians to kind of go off.
Can you tell us about the time that you played Auld Lang Syne at the end of it?
Yeah, I think it was in Italy. That was cool. So, as I said, you know, the first part of the song was kind of locked down, and then we would get into the big part in the middle. And So the end would turn into this huge epic thing, and Morrissey would throw himself on the stage, and he would curl up in the fetal position, and the musicians would kind of go crazy, and the drummer would be banging on the big bass drum, Matt Walker, or Dean, and then out of that it would kind of, you know, down get smaller and smaller, and then it was supposed to just be left with the piano playing something, maybe that kind of flew back to the beginning of the song, but maybe not. So oftentimes, because of my classical background, I can play by ear, and oftentimes he'd say, "Hey, play this," and he would make suggestions to try just something, some song that he liked and he wanted to hear. I don't remember if he suggested it or if it just came out, but maybe it was close to New Year's. I don't know. But in any event, so it came down to the end of the song, and I started playing Auld Lang Syne on the piano, and there was kind of a delay effect on it. It was a little raindroppy, tinkly, and so I just finished it off, and then that was the end of the set. You know, the other guys had kind of left, and I finished it, and I came off stage, and he was so amped. He ran up to me, and he was like, "That was awesome! I can't believe you did that." It was pretty cool to see him react like that. You know, because like I said, it's just a guy who loves music who thought he heard something cool.
Thank you.
that's a Morrissey title. No one else would write that song.
Absolutely. And tell us about playing There Is a Light That Never Goes Out.
Yeah, that was a real treat. One of my favorite Smith songs, for sure. I think that, you know, I heard that when I was a teenager, and I think that just taps into all the insecurity and unsure feelings that you have when you're a teenager. And you know, I remember hearing it. Queen Is Dead is one of my favorite records. And I remember hearing it on that, and what a magnificent song it was. And then to get to play it with him as on stage, you know, that's the song where people will just lose their minds. So we often played that as the last song, because sometimes, you know, the people would come on stage and that would be it, he's gone. So that's a really special song for me, for sure.
Absolutely. Okay, thanks for talking about Morrissey in so much detail. Another artist that you worked quite closely with on tour, I think it was in 2012, was Alanis Morissette. Mm-hmm. And wow, you played some classic songs during that tour. I was listening to it on the way here, and wow, she can sing as well. You know, what an artist.
We actually just passed the 20th anniversary of Jagged Little Pill, which was her big record.
Classic album.
She has there's some kind of anniversary edition that's just been released. So
great. And what you know, tell us about working with Alanis. Do you still work with her now, or is it just for that particular tour?
I do. There's some discussions about maybe some things going on next year. She recently has been, she has a little boy, and she's been working on a book, and she's been doing speaking engagements, so she's kind of diverted from music a little bit. But she has, she's an amazingly gracious woman. She's a great artist. She's very nurturing as far as encouraging us to try what we want on stage and to be involved with, you know, her creatively. She's a real treat to work for.
We hear it out the way a 3-year old would do. May hey out it down. You're gonna have to eventually anyway. The fire truck star coming up around the night, and you learn, you learn, you love, you learn, you cry, you learn, you love, you learn, you read.
One of the things that Alanis is great at is, I talked earlier about how important it is to, on tour, to get along with people, and she's great at finding the combination of people that will gel together musically, first of all, but also personally. She's, you know, a lot of my best friends are people from that tour. We keep in touch. We all have other jobs that we do. But when Alanis calls, it's a special thing, because we know it's going to be worth it. It's going to be a valuable time together doing cool things, playing music and being with people that you really care about. So she's I throw that all back on her. She's very selective, and she's very careful about picking the people that she wants, because she wants every tour to be a really special event. And it has been, the ones that I've worked on. And what it all boils down to, he said, no one's really.
You give to young musicians working with big personalities? You've shared the stage with the likes of Mariah Carey and someone like that. You know, what advice would you give to young musicians in that situation, perhaps for the first time?
Show up with a smile on your face. Be nice. It's not about you playing the piano or playing the drums or playing the bass. You have to be a little bit egoless, even though we all get into this business because we feel like, I'm going to be up there, people are going to see me, I'm going to play, watch this lick, watch me play this, watch me sing this. When you get into a situation where you're a backing musician, you are not the point. So it is very important for you to be a support for whoever it is, whether it's Mariah Carey or Alanis or whoever you're working for. They need to be able to look at you and feel like you got their back. Because, I mean, put yourself in their position. They have all different demands being made upon them, musical and otherwise. And sometimes their eyes just turn glazed because they have people coming up to them and saying, you need to get your hair done, you need to do this and wear this and change that song, and here's a remix. And after a while, I think your head just spins. And so if you look back at your band and your band seems like they've got your back, that's really important. The second thing is be prepared. Don't show up and think that you're going to fake your way through it. Learn the songs, learn the parts, don't rewrite the parts. Your job is to learn music and go play it. It's kind of simple. And that's how I've gotten, that's how I feel like I've gotten most of the jobs that I've gotten. So someone calls me and they say, come play with us. I learn the song. I learn what's on the song. I play that. And I don't need to rewrite it. That's not what they're asking me to do. Unless it's, you know, it's an improv meet. That's different.
And as a songwriter yourself, I mean, talk us through any, have you ever had writer's block or have you ever had any issues completing particular songs or projects?
I never have. I'm really lucky, although I definitely have a more difficult time with words. Music comes to me very easily. I can spit that out. I can change it. I can move it around. Lyrics are much harder for me. And that's why it's nice to work with artists like Morrissey or you know, they handle the lyrics and I can just keep funneling the music.
Things couldn't be any better if you're struggling for lyrics and you can give it to Morrissey.
I'm not going to do any better than that.
Yeah, great stuff. Okay, and what ambitions do you have left in the music industry, Mike?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm very happy with the things that I've done. I've played for thousands of people. I've gotten to write film scores. I've gotten to work on TV shows. I've gotten to do a lot of really neat stuff. I think I hope for another 10 or 15 years. It's hard to have a career that extends in music. You know, music is in a lot of ways about here and now, and then it moves on to something else. So I think longevity is what I would hope for. And I think what everyone hopes for, because it's easy to cycle out of this as being too old or uncool or not being attached to the latest cool thing.
So obviously you play a lot on the American Idol, and I think you've done kind of the X Factor shows. How do you feel about those? Because there are arguments that some of the musicians of the caliber you've worked with, great musical integrity, such as Alanis Morissette and Morrissey, do you think that those kind of shows are stifling the artistic creativity in young musicians because they have to be a particular thing to then become successful, in inverted commas?
Right. Well, I think you're right to a certain degree. Although, the thing that I focus on when I work on these shows, and I've heard lots of artists criticize them, but the thing that I focus on is this young little kid in front of me who wants to be a singer. They are, to them, this is the most important thing in the world. They want to do well. They don't want to be humiliated. They want to go out. They're going to be singing for millions and millions of people, so I really want to serve them and give them the best musical training that they have. Now, whether or not American Idol winners are great musicians is another discussion. I think you can say that it's different to be a singer as opposed to be an artist, because the artists today tend to write a lot of their own material. Well, this is a singing competition. This is not a writing competition. So that's different. I 100% believe in being able to write your own material, but that's just not what those TV shows are about.
Okay, great answer. Thank you very much. How much do you view being a musician as a job? Is it a job to you?
Sometimes it is. Most times it's not. I mean, there are times where you feel like, oh, I don't want to go to this thing, or it's just. But once you get there, the day just disappears because you're playing music. And when you talk to other people and you tell them what they do and you hear what they do, I never feel like, oh, I wish I was a dentist. Oh gosh, people are always impressed. When you see it through their eyes, you realize what a special thing it is. You realize how lucky we are to be able to do this for a living.
Great stuff. Well, you've played on records and you've played on live recordings that are going to be viewed by millions and millions of people well after you and I on this planet. So you should be very proud of your contribution to the music industry. And I thank you for appearing today.
Right on. Thanks for having me, Chris. Good questions.
Thanks, man. Yeah.
Are you in London?
I am, yeah.
Cool. I'll let you know next time I'm there.
Yeah, we'll go out for a beer, perhaps. I mean,
that'd be great. That'll be my fee for being on the show.
Great. Okay. One beer. I might do a second one if you're lucky. All right. Cheers. Thanks, Mike. See you later.
Keeping the loop of other episodes of the Stage Left Podcast, go to www.thestageleftpodcast.com, follow us on Twitter at The Stage Left Pod, and like us on Facebook at facebook.com/thestageleftpodcast. See you next time.